Looking at the huge crowd in St. Peter's Square, it's easy to forget that this has been a year of crisis for the Catholic Church, a year marked by the shock resignation of one pope and the subsequent election of Pope Francis, the world's first Latin American pope. I'm Mark Dowd, and for Inside the Vatican, here on the BBC World Service, I'll be investigating the story behind these dramatic events. People are now talking about a Francis effect. Empty churches are suddenly filling up, and the new pope is winning rave reviews all over the world, even from atheists. But not long ago, his church was mired in a series of scandals that exposed corruption at the heart of the Vatican. I've gained access to some of the church's senior figures. Their stories reveal the turmoil in Rome that many believe led to the resignation of the Pope's predecessor, Benedict XVI. His successor may be grabbing the headlines, but can he clean up the mess at the heart of the Vatican?
We came on February 11th for a routine meeting for approval of saints to be canonized. It was a normal 25-minute event. When we were about to go, Pope Benedict said, "Please sit down, I have something to say." And that made a big difference, what he had to say in the next 5 minutes.
Based in Rome for nearly 30 years, the Nigerian cardinal, Francis Arinze, was once the bookie's favourite to become the first black pope. He was there when the pope resigned and is the first English-speaking cardinal to reveal exactly what happened.
I became apprehensive once he began reading a prepared text in Latin. In words like, "I have reflected over this for a long time. Before God, it is clear to me that the church is best served by another." It became clear to me where he was going to end. The rest was just details.
And what were the looks on the faces of the other cardinals around you?
Each one looked at the other. Nobody said anything. It was like a thunder that normally gives no notice that it's about to come. It was clear. We are in historic times.
No one had done this for 600 years.
No. We knew that a pope can resign. It's quite another matter when a pope de facto has told the cardinals, "I give you 2 weeks. In 2 weeks' time, I will not be pope anymore. It will be at 8 o'clock on February 28th.
So why did Joseph Ratzinger, better known as Pope Benedict, decide to resign? It's true that sex abuse scandals had taken their toll on the church, but he'd taken steps to tackle it with a policy of zero tolerance. His resignation statement referred to his waning physical and mental strength. But we've spoken to well-placed sources who say the real reason was that the Vatican had become ungovernable. It culminated in the so-called VatiLeaks scandal, the leaking of secret documents from the papal palace. In the bar of a Rome hotel, where some of those files changed hands, I met the man who plunged the church into meltdown.
When VatiLeaks came out, Cardinal Bertone said Italy now has its own Dan Brown. But he was wrong, because Dan Brown writes fiction, and I write fact. Truth is stranger than fiction, and what you think you know about the Vatican isn't the half of it.
TV journalist Gianluigi Nuzzi is a bald, solidly built man in his mid-40s, with an eye-catching scar running down his right cheek. In 2009, Nuzzi published a book on Vatican finances, which he says gained him a reputation in the Roman Curia, the church's civil service, as an objective and forensic operator. As a result, a group Nuzzi calls the Maria Collective made contact with him using tactics straight out of the Da Vinci Code.
My first meeting was not with the person I was supposed to be meeting, but with two go-betweens. It was in a bar near the Vatican, and I soon realized that, as well as these two strangers I was talking to, there were other people in the bar who were checking that we weren't being watched. After that, they drove me to an apartment, but they took a very complicated route, so I had no idea where we were going, and so that they were sure that no one was following us. Another time, I met someone in this hotel, and he told me not to use a certain telephone number that I had not even told him I had, because the phone was being bugged. Bear in mind that For security reasons, the Vatican has a lot of contact with the secret services. So, I used to keep a copy of all the documents on a USB stick that I wore around my neck at all times.
Did you not ever worry about the motives of the people who were giving you these documents and that perhaps you were being manipulated?
No.
No. Because the stories that emerge from the documents are true. The question we could ask is why would someone who cares for the Pope want to bring these church scandals into the open? There's only one answer to that question. Because Ratzinger's attempts to change things were consistently blocked by the Curia. In the last phase of his pontificate, Ratzinger was very isolated, and that left him weakened. And faced with this, certain people tried to help him by letting others know what was going on.
Affinché tutti conoscano.
Pope Benedict was a theologian, not a manager. But as head of the Catholic Church, he was meant to be kept informed. Too often, this wasn't happening, especially on potentially explosive matters involving church finances. John Thavis, for 25 years a Vatican correspondent and author of The Vatican Diaries, recounts one tale which unfolded right under the Pope's window.
So here we are in the middle of St. Peter's Square in the shadow of the obelisk. This is the spot where every year workmen assemble the nativity scene. And in a few days' time, the Vatican workmen are going to bring in truckloads of material and start building this giant nativity scene, larger than life. And it's a big crowd drawer. A lot of pilgrims come, a lot of families come to see this. It's unveiled on Christmas Eve. They gather around and sing Christmas carols. Of course, no one knew how much it was costing them to do this every year.
How much was it costing them?
Well, it ended up, they were paying 550,000 euros simply to construct this nativity scene. And they were reusing, of course, the materials. It wasn't like they had to start from scratch. So, in effect, the church was spending, yes, more than half a million euros to remind the world that Jesus was born in a poor manger.
And why was it costing so much?
Well, obviously, it was one of these Italian contracts that, you know, they were paying them well more than they should have been. Once this was discovered, of course, the costs were cut way back, but it took a whistleblower to finally point this out.
And once they looked, they realized this wasn't the only contract of this kind.
Well, in fact, there were other contracts that soon came to the attention of the whistleblower, Archbishop Vigano.
Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano had been appointed in July 2009 as Secretary General of the Vatican City State. He started to go through the books and discovered the Nativity was just one of many suspicious overspends. He cut costs, but in doing so, he made enemies. 2 years into the job, he was suddenly moved to a new post, 4,000 miles away in Washington, as a Vatican ambassador. Technically, the new job was a promotion, but Archbishop Vigano didn't see it that way. He wrote to the Pope to express his distress, and the letter was leaked to Gianluigi Nuzzi and to an Italian newspaper.
In other circumstances, such an appointment would be a reason for joy and a sign of great esteem and trust in my regard, but in the present context, it will be perceived by all as a verdict of condemnation of my work, and therefore as a punishment. My transfer would provoke confusion among all those who believe that it's possible to clean up so many situations of corruption and dishonesty.
Archbishop Vigano was packed off to Washington, and his letter was leaked to Gianluigi Nuzzi and an Italian newspaper. The finger of suspicion soon fell on the Pope's butler, Paolo Gabriele. As a trusted personal assistant, he had unfettered access to the papal apartments and offices. 82 boxes, some containing personal documents of the Pope, were discovered in his Vatican apartment. His lawyer, Christiana Aru, clutched her rosary beads as she told me how he came to be charged.
He was arrested on a Wednesday evening, and on the Friday before, Gianluigi Nuzzi's book had been published. That book was like a bomb going off in the Vatican, because it contained copies of documents that no one to this day has dismissed as fakes. So the contents of these documents came from the Holy See, indeed from the Pope's own office. Bear in mind that I was appointed Paolo Gabriele's lawyer on the Thursday, and I was in the Vatican from 10 in the morning until 8 at night. And once I finished work, the first thing I did was to go and buy the book, but all the bookshops around the Vatican had sold out because obviously all the Vatican staff had bought it.
But what about Gabriele's motives? Did you say to him simply, why have you done this?
Paolo Gabriele is on the record as saying that he believed he was an envoy of the Holy Spirit. sent to carry out a moral mission. He said that he had seen many ugly things inside the Vatican, not so much in the church in general, but in the Apostolic Palace, the place where he worked. At a certain point, he couldn't take it anymore, and so he looked for a way out. He says he saw lies being told. He thought that the Pope was being kept in the dark about key events. He knew that Pope Benedict was, and still is, a gentle and timid soul, and he was scared of shocking him. And therefore his logic was that a media storm would help him achieve his goal.
It also landed him in a Vatican jail, although after 3 months in custody, the Pope pardoned him. But by then, Nuzzi's book was climbing up the bestseller chart, and Cardinal Francis Arinze concedes he found temptation difficult to resist.
That's the sort of thing people want to read.
Did you read them?
I did. I bought a copy. I wanted to read. And I said to myself, oh, how is it that some people wrote some of these things? Second, how is it that some people leaked this type of thing?
What did you learn from reading those documents?
Oh, many things. For instance, I read there that someone sent a card to the Pope's secretary and said, this check is for the Holy Father. Then he wrote there, could I get audience for myself and my wife and so on? So we cannot say it is a bribe, but it is not pleasant.
Paolo Gabrielli said he thought he was the agent of the Holy Spirit.
I didn't think he was acting for the Holy Spirit. I did not think so. But who knows? They said that God can write straight on crooked lines. So, human beings act, but God can bring out good even out of actions that we don't think are correct. We don't like the scandal. No, we cannot like a scandal. But we can learn from them. And we should.
If scandal brings opportunities for learning, then one rich source of lessons is the Vatican Bank. Located in the sovereign state of the Vatican City, this institution is not subject to Italian law. John Thavis, author of the Vatican Diaries.
The Vatican Bank has been a PR nightmare because, number one, it's had actual financial scandals in the past. And the real problem here is that it was set up as a kind of foundation to move church funds around the world. But over the years, it accumulated about 30,000 private accounts. These accounts were really not regulated at all. And so they're an obvious place, especially if you're an Italian, to park money and to move it in and out without being seen. And I'm afraid that's what's happened here. Normally when we've seen some of these scandals come to light, it's because some Vatican Bank account, a private account, has been used in a way that it should not have been. And once Italy started tightening up the banking rules to conform to international standards, the Vatican became kind of the last place that wasn't doing this. And so, unfortunately, it's attracted the kind of people who want to do illegal things with their money.
Strictly speaking, the Vatican Bank is not a bank, and its proper title is the Institute for Religious Works, or the IOR. Traditionally, the bank has had flexible rules, accepting cash donations so that money can reach poor communities, often in troubled parts of the world. This made it attractive to money launderers. So in December 2010, Pope Benedict passed a directive known as a motu proprio to tighten up on potential money laundering and improve transparency. But he met with resistance. Franca Gian Soldati from the Roman daily Il Messaggero has been covering the Vatican for 20 years, and she says the Pope was outmaneuvered by his Secretary of State, Cardinal Bertone, who moved to pass a new law which weakened the reforms.
Benedict published a motu proprio, creating a financial regulator that had precise and wide-ranging powers, the power to poke its nose into any Vatican bank account. When the new law came out, it basically meant that the Vatican Bank's regulator had had its wings clipped and could no longer check for wrongdoing in the Vatican Bank.
In 2009, a new president, Ettore Gotti Tedeschi, was brought in by Pope Benedict to clean up the bank. A respected economist and banker and a member of Opus Dei, he was close to the Pope. But just like Archbishop Viganò, he encountered resistance from his colleagues. And on the 24th of May 2012, the day after Paolo Gabriele's arrest, Gotti Tedeschi was abruptly ousted from the bank by its board of directors. Franca Giansoldati again.
The story of Paolo Gabriele, when it exploded, hit something far more important, the game that was being played out inside the Vatican Bank. Pope Benedict knew nothing about Gotti Tedeschi's dismissal. I know this from good sources and from my own research. The mass media, me included, from January last year, we were all focused on the story of the traitor butler. It was like the ultimate detective story. And it was a bit like a smokescreen, because it distracted us from what I now think was the real story, which was the secret battle over this issue of making the Vatican Bank more transparent. La trasparenza dello
IOR. Last month, Pope Benedict's private secretary, Archbishop Georg Genswein, gave an interview in which he said the Pope had been very surprised by Gotti Tedeschi's removal. It was another setback, but Joseph Ratzinger still appeared determined to carry on as Pope. He appointed three senior cardinals to investigate VatiLeaks. They produced a 300-page report for the Pope's eyes only. But its contents were also leaked. An Italian newspaper claimed it revealed a gay lobby at the heart of the Roman Curia. Once again, the church was in the news for the wrong reasons. So the question remains, a possible gay lobby, instability at the Vatican Bank and the VatiLeaks affair. Did the combination of all these prove too much for Pope Benedict? Cardinal Francis Arinze.
We could not ask him, is it fever, is it headache, is it stomachache? Did the doctor say to you, don't? We could not ask that. We could begin guessing. People would have theories because he did not tell us why. So it is legitimate for a person to speculate and say, maybe he was so pained that his own butler leaked out so many letters that a journalist was able to write a book. It can be one of the reasons. I don't expect him to be enjoying that event.
I asked Father Federico Lombardi, the papal press spokesman, what he thought.
There were several factors in Pope Benedict's resignation that he outlined in a very clear and simple way in his resignation speech. He said he lacked the strength to carry out his ministry, and that the church needed someone with more physical and spiritual energy who would be able to overcome the problems and challenges of governing the church in this ever-changing modern world. So there was definitely an element of physical aging, particularly when it came to traveling and presiding over big religious ceremonies. At the same time, he also talked about needing more spiritual energy, not personal faith, but the psychological strength necessary to deal with difficult issues of church governance.
And we now know precisely what these issues of governance were. The cardinals who elected the new pope could not have known how popular he would prove. Crowds at the weekly papal audience have doubled since his arrival. But what the cardinals did know about Jorge Mario Bergoglio was that he had never lived in Rome. So why did they choose the ultimate outsider? The papal press spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi, was unusually frank about their motives.
If someone is looking for a renewal of what we do in Rome, the fact of taking someone who comes from elsewhere probably guarantees that renewal.
That's putting a nice gloss on it, but I think the cardinals, what you're saying, is they chose somebody who didn't want to be captured by the system.
Definitely. And this is something Pope Francis has showed very clearly from the beginning, that he is not someone who can be captured by the system. He's shown this through little gestures like changing where he lives from the papal apartment, where all his predecessors lived, to the St. Martha Hostel. And I think this was a statement of intent. His way of showing that he doesn't want to be conditioned by the fact that things have always been done a certain way.
Well, Pope Francis came out of the gate pretty fast.
Vatican Diaries author John Thavis.
He named the group of eight cardinals who are going to help him reform the Roman Curia. And, you know, that move was very astute, I think. He put the fate of Curia reform in the hands of people who don't work in the Roman Curia. Only one of these cardinals actually works at the Vatican. So I think here he has a small group, small enough to actually effect reforms, and they seem to be moving forward fairly quickly by Vatican standards. He's reforming finance, as we've seen, by appointing serious oversight commissions, and in some cases they're being asked to look at fundamental operating procedures and, you know, the very existence of a thing like the Vatican Bank. That could be huge.
Pope Francis has made reform of the Vatican Bank a top priority. He's issued a new, even tighter law against money laundering. And he's opened the bank's books to a team of 25 experts from Promontory, a US firm that specialises in regulatory compliance. They're checking all accounts for dodgy transactions. About time too, some critics may say. But this is just the start of a major shake-up. High above Rome, in one of the city's oldest churches, Santa Sabina, I met with a former Master General of the Dominican Order, Father Timothy Ratcliffe, in town for a series of high-level meetings. What, I asked him, are the longer-term implications of the reforms that Pope Francis has set in train?
I think he does wish to reform the Roman Curia, and the cardinals elected him to reform the Roman Curia. But this is much more than just changing a bureaucracy. It's about rethinking what sort of community the church is. Because we've tended to think of the church over recent centuries as rather like a monarchy ruled by this king from the centre. And the curia has been seen as the court. And I think what Pope Francis is doing is he's opening up that whole world. From the very beginning, on the balcony, when he asked for all the people in the square to be silent and to pray for him and with him, he showed that he was, first of all, a fellow disciple. Before you're a priest, before you're a bishop, before you're pope, you're a fellow disciple.
So if you're right, and if this man's reforms succeed over a number of years, you're talking about the transformation of the papacy.
You're talking about the transformation of the whole church.
Roaring crowds cheer on the Pope at midday prayer in St. Peter's. He's a leader whose popularity grows with every passing week, a useful weapon against those who'd see to turn back the clock. Pope Francis has seized an opportunity which has been forged out of scandal, and he's been gifted that chance by someone who made history. A man who saw that the task of cleaning up the mess at the heart of the church required a very different presence on the throne of St. Peter. You've been listening to Inside the Vatican with me, Mark Dowd. The producer was Helen Grady. The BBC World